This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 102nd episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is a field guide to behavioral science. I'm joined by Sarak Khan and Laurel Newman, who co-edited and contributed to Building Behavioral Science in an Organization. The publisher is Action Design Press, in conjunction with the University of Pennsylvania. Sarak Khan is a senior behavioral researcher at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. He also teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and is a board member of Action Design Network. Laurel Newman is a behavioral scientist at Edward Jones and a former college professor at Fontbonne University in St. Louis. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So what's this book about in a nutshell?
This book is sort of a culmination of a bunch of different experts putting their heads together about how you actually use behavioral science in the field. We realized that, you know, we knew a bunch of folks in a bunch of different areas that use behavioral science. They all have sort of different spins on it. And so we wanted to kind of pull that all together in one place and talk about not just sort of the concepts of behavioral science, biases and heuristics, that sort of thing. But once you're kind of bought in and you're trying to actually build, you know, a team or a function within your organization to implement this stuff, how do you go about doing that? And that's what the book's
okay.
about.
Okay. And Laurel, maybe you can help us level set. What in the world is behavioral science for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, behavioral science is kind of a general umbrella term. So it includes lots of different areas like economics, psychology. Some people think about behavioral science as being mostly kind of psychological biases and heuristics and things like nudge principles. So nudges are like, how do we design an environment in a way that will increase the probability that people will do the behavior we want? And often nudges are designed outside of people's awareness. So people don't often even realize that they're being nudged. So that's, you know, when a lot of people think about behavioral science, they think about these kind of smaller nudges and, you know, anticipating and dealing with cognitive biases. Sarak and I think take a broader approach to thinking of it in terms of kind of, you know, psychology, sociology, anything that might help us understand why people do what they do and how we can make changes to their environment to increase the probability that they'll do the things that are in, you know, hopefully their own best interest.
Sure. And Zaraka is, of course, at the Institute for Hindsight, because foresight is not necessarily one of the strengths of human nature.
Exactly, yes. Right? We all suffer from this hindsight bias, so why not just get out in front of it?
Absolutely. So I was curious, in the introduction, it seems like, if I remember right, there was a statement that behavioral science seemed to kind of take off as a discipline, roughly speaking, maybe 2013. Kind of begs the question, why then? And then also, what's fueling the growth?
Well, it's been, a part of academia for a very long time, right? So, I mean, the fields that Laurel mentioned are foundational, right? So there's been, extensive research into human behavior for a very, very long time. The jump to sort of application has, I think, kind of taken, it's happened in sort of fits and starts in different places. I think, the date that we have there, or sort of, early 2000s, is probably when it started kind of moving into government, which is sort of where they first kind of started, like, nudges, right? This is where this term became popular, right? So famous from the book by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein.
Yep, Thaler.
And then Thaler was one of the sort of original advisors to the Behavioral Insights team in the UK, which was originally called the Nudge Unit. And now there are all these nudge units that have sort of sprung up all around the world, including, we have one here in the U.S. That has sort of a different name. But so that was the first sort of step. And then, companies and industry caught on and have started to try to, implement it or integrate it or introduce it to the work that they do as well. There are some places that started probably earlier and would say that they've been doing it for longer, like marketing. And then there are some where it's sort of, a little bit newer, or at least the application is a little bit more novel.
Okay. Yeah. No, I, for instance, wrote a book called Emotionomics, published about 2007. And, it was a lot of it was really in the marketing realm and having to do with, looking at behavioral economics principles and, acknowledging that obviously we're not making really not making decisions and not having reactions to, for instance, advertising based on cognitive, rational, utilitarian factors alone, and indeed far from it. Mm-hmm. Laurel, in your case, you mentioned that HR, human resources, is a lagging application. I say that because I think the percentage was 8% of the work in this field seems to have been in the HR. Why do you think HR is a lagging application, if indeed that's true?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that HR, in a lot of cases, people hire behavioral scientists because in the end, they want to impact client behavior, because client behavior is what impacts revenue for the company, first and foremost. So if they have a limited number of behavioral scientists or a limited budget for behavioral science, they're often going to put people on things like product or marketing that they think will have a really fast and direct impact on client behavior. HR is more of a long game. It's investing in behavioral science that can help test things and improve things for internal employees often, which can help with retention and productivity and innovation and, things like that, that wrap back around in time and lead the company to be more successful, but that don't have quite the same sort of straight line to an outcome like sales that you could see if you invest in other areas.
Okay, so the ROI is not as readily apparent to executives, for instance.
That's my opinion, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. We're all here about what's your opinions, what's your feelings. That's all within bounds and legit. Do you think the executives are, where do you think they're at in terms of understanding the importance of behavioral science? This is still for you, Laurel. We're going to jump over to innovation and Zaraka here in a bit.
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of variability. I mean, there's sort of a classic way of thinking about employee motivation that's focused heavily on extrinsic rewards, things like compensation and bonuses and even benefits and things like that. Those things are often easier and cleaner to design and test the effects of. Things like investing in intrinsic motivation can be a little more nuanced, and a little bit harder to, you have to make more structural changes sometimes to the workplace. And you have to have often lagging measures. This is something that I think, I've seen business people don't love in general is the idea of lagging measures. You know, let's test this and tell me in 2 or 3 weeks if it works, or tell me tomorrow if it works. The idea of changing employee culture and changing employee motivation, retention, those things take a while for us to assess in terms of, you know, in research, we call it dependent variable measurement. That's another reason why I think there's often a preference for making changes that we can kind of assess the impact of right away. But I think there are a lot of companies that realize, you know, you can really attract and retain top-notch talent if you're willing to invest in these things and if you're willing to offer employees an environment that they really look forward to coming to and where they feel like they can reach their full potential and they're supported. And, you know, there's just sort of an energy to businesses like that. And I think increasingly businesses who are of that mindset are starting to invest in those kind of longer term approaches.
So do you think that that percentage of it, you know, being 8% in a lagging application, do you see good odds that that's going to materially look different in, say, 5 years from now? And I say that in part because obviously we're speaking in the context of the Great Resignation, and we're speaking in the context of, you know, even more almost desperate, you know, a war for talent, mm-hmm. and making sure it doesn't go elsewhere in retention. So I know it's the crystal ball, but I'm curious what you might think.
Yeah. I mean, you took the words right out of my mouth with the Great Resignation. I think companies have to, you know, they have to start thinking differently about how do we understand our employees more as kind of rounded human beings, and how do we create environments that meet a more like a broader set of human needs so that people can really, you know, there's a lot of research on the importance of psychological safety and people being able to kind of be who they are at work and things like that. That's really important. But what we're talking about here is beyond that. It's really creating environments that kind of motivate and acknowledge and recognize and support the types of behaviors and outcomes that are going to be beneficial for the company, but also that are going to be meaningful for the individual person. So I think that there will be definitely an increase in attention to behavioral science in HR and employee space. And I think it'll be not just designing environments that are more, you know, that make employees happier, but also thinking more about what are the kinds of deeper psychological needs that employees have and how can we address those needs so that people really feel bought in and connected to the workplace.
No, I love that answer. I think that's really an important initiative that needs to be taking place. You'd also mentioned, and we're going to jump to Sirach here after just one more question. You had mentioned some behavioral economic principles that you thought were applicable to employee culture and HR. And I was very much taken by that because I've always considered my work on the importance of emotion in business to be tied into behavioral economics as a fellow traveler. So you mentioned loss aversion, social proof, ego depletion. I'm hoping you can both speak to those. And then I was wondering about another one, which was inequality aversion. I have to think that the regular employee looking at, for instance, the compensation of executives might find that pertinent.
Mm-hmm. So I'll talk here for a moment and then let Sirach speak his mind. Loss aversion is an important one. You know, for anyone who isn't familiar with that, it's the idea that when people receive something, it's, you know, it feels good, but when they lose something of equal value, it feels much worse than the good that they get from receiving it. So this is something that we keep in mind when we begin new programs or new rewards or things like that. You know, even things like recognition, if you give people something and then you decide, hey, we're not really getting the ROI or the impact that we wanted out of that, and then you pull it back, it usually leads to a lot of blowback. People feel kind of, you know, offended and hurt, and they don't understand why, you know, from their perspective, often it's been making them feel good. So why would you remove it? So that's just sort of a cautionary tale about tinkering with things and saying, well, let's try this. And if it doesn't work, we'll just change it. Sometimes that's a good, you know, sometimes that's a good thing to do. But when it comes to actually giving people things, it's not often an easy thing to take them away.
Sure. Makes sense.
Yeah. What was another one that you mentioned?
Social proof, mm-hmm. ego depletion, and then I brought up the specter of inequality aversion.
Mm-hmm. Sirach, do you want to talk about one of those?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing, before I get into a specific of one of those three, I mean, you know, in your sort of introduction to behavioral science, Laurel, right, you talked about they're kind of like these different fields or academic disciplines that we bring to bear on the problems that we are trying to solve. And oftentimes those kind of happen at two levels of maybe levels of granularity or specificity, right? So sometimes there is like a very specific behavior or action that we want an employee to do, or that we think is sort of, you know, beneficial for them or for the organization. And so an example of this, right, might be we do this, we think about this a lot in the work that we do with my team at Duke, is enrollment in benefits, right? So the biggest change to, you know, long-term savings in the U.S., retirement savings, has nothing to do with interest rates, has nothing to do with, you know, compelling marketing or anything like that. It basically is that companies switched from an opt-in to an opt-out of their 401k programs or their savings programs. And so you see a dramatic, you know, shift in behavior or in this outcome because of a very, very small design change on a form or an onboarding process, right? So that's kind of one level where we think about things like nudges and friction and defaults and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this sort of higher level, and Laurel spent time kind of describing this, where it's more around like, okay, well, defaulting somebody into a 401k maybe, you know, has sort of limited effect or impact on their, you know, on the great resignation, right? Like this is something where we think at a higher level, like, well, why are you here in the first place, you know? And when you ask people, you know, who have stayed either jobs that they liked, where you say, hey, like, what was your favorite thing about that job? Or it seems like you really didn't like that job. Like, why did you stay there so long? The answers tend to be kind of similar, right? Where it's like, well, I really like the people I worked with. I really liked my boss. The work was really meaningful, whatever, you know. So there's always something that kind of keeps people there. And it's very rarely, you know, exclusively just sort of an extrinsic reason. Like, well, you know, I got paid this money to do it, right?
Yeah.
Less and less the case now, right, with the sort of departure of things like pensions, right, where you're sort of paying into this and you're kind of getting this defined payout over time. Mm-hmm. So I think when you think about sort of biases or behavioral principles, right, we kind of think of those two levels of specificity, right? Some that are very, very specific on like discrete behaviors that we think employees might be doing or that we think they should do, like signing up for benefits. And then the other is sort of like at a high level, what are kind of, you know, concepts that we sort of want to bake into just the way that we have set up our organization and the way that we do our work.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around a lot to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Okay, no, I like that a lot. So staying with you, Sirach, switching over to innovation, I was intrigued at one point you state the difference between looking innovative, such as hackathons, feeling innovative, you invite in a speaker, for instance, and actually being innovative. So I think that begs an opportunity for you to elaborate on that a bit.
Love the opportunity, Dan. Yeah, this was like very helpful for me in in sort of, you know, kind of developing an understanding of, yeah, as like a innovation professional, like what the heck am I supposed to even be spending my time doing? Because, you know, and this was like, you know, it's basically like this, I'm spending most of my time thinking about this. So imagine somebody who only spends, you know, an hour a month thinking about it, right? So there's a lot of like a need for clarity around this stuff if you're building out an innovation strategy. And so one of the things that I've done and helped other organizations do is let's map out all the things that you do that you think are innovation activities, right? And I sort of developed this by talking with other friends and folks who are in similar roles. And, within a week, they would come back and say, man, like I was able to kind of map this whole thing out with my organization too, and sort of see which pieces should be working together more closely, which ones are like things that should be funded by a totally different part of the organization. So to sort of build this out a little bit, you know, there are activities that, you know, that an organization might do to demonstrate to the market, to, you know, their competitors or to their clients, that they are an innovative company. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually producing anything, a sort of a meaning to the organization itself, right? You're just sort of showing people.
It's a dog and pony show, man.
Yeah, exactly, right? We put on this big event and we invite a bunch of speakers and it's like, wow, that must be a cool, you know, organization. They're doing all this great stuff. Okay, but like, does that translate into, you know, an improvement of your product or better services, whatever? Like, you know, probably not, you know, if that's the only thing you're doing. This second category of sort of feeling innovative, it's similar to the first one, but it's turned inwards, right? So you're saying, oh, we've got like a ping pong table and, you know, in the rec room or cafeteria or whatever, like this is a cool place to work, you know? And so, you know, this is basically convincing the people that work there that, hey, we're doing cool stuff. This is a fun environment. We must be like an innovative organization. And there's nothing wrong with either of those things. But the third category is what I chose to sort of focus on in this chapter in the book of being innovative, where I used to kind of visualize this as like a tree in a garden. And so the garden is sort of like, there's like ground cover, right? That's sort of like feeling innovative, looking innovative. It's like, well, there's lots of flowers and sort of pretty things there, but like what you're really hoping for is this like sturdy tree, and the tree is like, you know, that we're being innovative here, and there's different branches to this, right? Of sort of, are we, you know, generating ideas, and there's lots of activities that you can think of to sort of generate ideas. Are we assessing them in some way? Are we testing them and scaling them? You know, so that's sort of what the focus, where if you're being innovative, it makes it much easier to look and feel innovative. If you're only looking and feeling innovative and you're not actually being innovative, it starts to sort of not feel very genuine.
Sure. Well, you might appreciate the fact that my father was in charge of 3M printed post-it notes.
No.
And innovation was very central to 3M, and you were supposed to devote, I think it was as much as 20% of your time to actually generating ideas. So lo and behold, much later in my career, I ended up being the director of executive communications for a Fortune 200 company. One of my charges was the annual report. I laid aside a 2-page spread for new innovations in our $6 billion revenue company. I had to pull the section. There was nothing worth reporting on.
Could fit it on a post-it note.
Exactly.
I was going to say, maybe they gave
maybe
you all
even
that
more so
time.
If I left the post-it note blank. But, So there was another thing in your chapter, Sirach, I wanted to go to, because I think it's germane to this show and its name, but also just to what you were arguing for, which is that innovative initiatives involve thoughts, emotions, and relationships. Because I'm trying to get at here, in part, the importance, if you're going to make something happen, you're going to have to get buy-in, which is the relationships part. But I'm hoping you can speak to emotions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of these things are relevant. And it's this, again, kind of to echo this theme that's come up a couple times already of there are sort of different levels of operating within, you know, behavioral science or things that we might use in trying to solve these problems or create a behavioral science function. You're not going to be able to just kind of nudge people into creating transformational innovations, right? And so you have to think about, well, is there some, you know, or is our incentive structure set up in a way that actually facilitates this, or in a way that is detrimental to these efforts? And so, you know, the classic example here is Clay Christensen's work with disruptive innovation, right? Where it doesn't really matter if, you know, you can have the right mindsets, you can have the right, everyone likes each other, you can have great relationships, But if your organization is set up in a way where, you know, if the success of this new innovation means sort of the death or just to the detriment of your existing business, well, yeah, it's going to get killed, you know, even if everyone's excited about it and everyone likes each other. Like, so you have to be a little bit more holistic in kind of thinking about this as a system and how it interacts with the other parts of the organization beyond just sort of, you know, nudges and behavioral principles here. So, so you have to think about, okay, well, how are people, you know, the relationships they have with each other, but, you know, to your point or your question about emotions, right? Like, well, if the success of this feels like that it's going to make somebody else feel as though they are failing and you need that person's buy-in to, you know, maintain this initiative, well, you have to be pretty thoughtful then about how you frame the work. So it sort of just kind of prompts you to be more thoughtful in general about how you're sort of setting up the process, but also the people that are involved and how you're going to have to interact with all of them.
Okay, and Laurel, on that same theme, because I mean, surely in your work at Edward Jones, I mean, you're in effect an in-house consultant, and you've got to build coalitions and buy-in as well. Did you have something more you wanted to say on this front?
Well, not specifically about Edward Jones. I just was going to say, sure, kind of to Zarak's point, I really liked in the chapter, Zarak, where you talk about the difference between incremental innovation, which is kind of small, gradual changes, which are really part of just running any business, as you're always improving things, versus adjacent innovations versus transformational innovations. And what you're talking about there, I think, are transformational innovations. When a company realizes that something that has previously made them a lot of money and been successful is sort of falling out of fashion for one reason or another, and it's in danger of maybe not being able to continue doing that, you see this a lot with organizations where there's almost a gambling mentality of, you know, how do we time this right so that we can kind of ride out the thing that's been working all these years, but not let it go on for so long that we've missed our opportunity to kind of change and develop something new that's going to be appealing to the newer market when this thing just no longer works.
Can you catch the next wave? I've read some research suggesting that, you know, something like only 16% of companies and organizations manage to catch that next wave as opposed to holding on to the last one to the point of death.
Right. But I think that one important point, though, is that a reason for having sort of a little innovation group separate from the rest of the business is that they're challenged with and rewarded for coming up with these transformational innovations. Because if you leave it up to the people, yep, whose career has been, you know, making this other thing work for all these years, we're all human, right? I mean, this is part of the deal, yep, is that it's really hard to say, you know, it's really hard to say even to yourself, this thing that I built that has worked all these years, that is sort of my pride and identity, needs to go away. And it's just not, you can't ask people to do that. So that's, I think, a really important reason to have people whose job is devoted to innovation and who, you know, are not tied to old ways of doing things.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I thought that was really one of the important aspects of the book was the candor on this front. Because, I mean, there's language like it's going to be an organ rejection. You're going to meet with resistance. Mm-hmm. There's going to be inertia. I mean, all of those things are very much true. I remember when I went out as an innovator, a friend of mine said, well, Dan, you're kind of like a missionary. You go out and the cannibals eat you alive. And it's true that the Catholic Church will canonize you, but that's 500 years later. And in the meantime, you'll have no heirs. it's hard being an innovator. It just is. One last question before we run out of time. It might be for Zarak, it might be for both of you. There is a point in the book where you mention some well-known behavioral science frameworks. There's EAST framework, Fogg model, the Hooked model, 3B framework. I'm throwing out all this terminology, but over time in your work, have there been certain models or just certain steps or key points to keep in mind, checkpoints to make your work work?
It's a great question. And it's something that actually, it's the very first lesson in the class that I teach at Penn in their MBDS program, is about frameworks. And the main point is really that, like, the trick is not like knowing every single framework, right? It's sort of like knowing which is the right one for the situation that you're in. To some extent, this again deals with specificity, right? Are you looking for just sort of a general, you know, it's early discovery and you're kind of looking for a general framework or model around behavior, well, you know, that's where something like COMB or 3Bs or FOG model or whatever, right? Like these are very, very general things where it's just like, okay, what's the behavior we're focused on? What are the barriers and are there benefits to this, right? So it doesn't give you the level of specificity that's going to actually, you know, tell you exactly what to do, but it's a starting point. And then there are some that are much more specific, right? So you mentioned like the hooked model around habits, right? So, you know, once you have sort of identified this is what you're trying to do, well, this might be a relevant framework for kind of thinking through that. And then, you know, once you develop fluency with both, you know, the actual science, right? Because all these models are basically, you know, they're sort of boiled down versions of a lot of different fields of study. Once you like have fluency with the science and with the area of application, like the industry or the, you know, the problem that you're focusing on, you might end up kind of developing your own framework or your own approach. And that's, you know, another kind of tool in your toolkit.
Sure. No, I think that's a very fair answer. So we're going to leave it there. I want to thank both of you, Sirach and Laurel, for your time. This has been episode number 102, A Field Guide to Behavioral Science. Sirach Khan and Laurel Newman are the co-editors as well as contributors to Building Behavioral Science in an Organization. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to New Books Network and typing in Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. And you'll see the other guests and books that we've covered on the program. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I couldn't resist one from Steven Pinker, who said, "Behavioral science is not for sissies." Until next time, take care and be well.